background. I've never met Steve. Well, if I get it wrong, please say. I had breakfast today. Was something happened that's not happened for quite a while in my life. I'm looking for who was on my table. We had a discussion about the teaching theory, methods, sociology, and science, and its place in ASAT sociology. We didn't agree. What's new? And so I'm hoping that Steve might touch on that, because for me, I'm absolutely fascinated, I'm sure a lot of you are, by the title of his lecture, The New Sociological Imagination. And I'm sure for many of us here, that will take us back to C. Wright Mills and the old sociological imagination. Amazing. I have visited, in this cyber age, Steve's homepage. And for me, he seems to be interested in this area of knowledge, epistemology. And when I first came to sociology, I was almost put off from the subject by the word pseudoscience. It was very early on, the magician of Paralambos, and I thought, what is this pseudo thing? No idea. I've learned a lot in the last number of years. I think for me, I've always loved teaching sociology, science, theories of knowledge. It's not something that I teach anymore, so I'm really looking forward to perhaps having my imagination sparked. On Steve's homepage at the University of Warwick, if you go on to this, it's very impressive. And I'm just going to quote from this. He's organised two global cyber conferences. He's spoken in over 25 countries. His book, The Intellectual, was named Book of the Year by the New Statesman in 2005. Therefore, I think it's a very great honour for us at the ATSS to have him here in Northampton. And I'll hand over to Steve. I would say, before Steve starts speaking, he is recording the lecture this morning and questions.
Okay, thank you very much for that introduction, and I hope nobody minds that I am taping this. If you do go to my website, one of the things that you will see is that I have lots of audio lectures that I've given over the years there. So if you want to find out more about me, especially in uncensored form, then that's a good place to go to. So that's the spirit in which I'm doing that here today, okay? The first thing I should say, this is the second time I've been at Northampton, and I want to thank Andy for bringing me back. It's a pleasure to be here. And what I want to do is, indeed, I do want to talk about The New Sociological Imagination, which was the name of a book that I published in 2006 with Sage. The issues that get raised there are the sorts of issues that I will be raising here, but now in a somewhat new key. And I think what I'm aiming for here is for us to get a clear sense of what do the social sciences, and in particular sociology, mean in the 21st century in light of all the changes that are taking place, especially on the side of the natural sciences and the biological sciences with regard to redefinitions of what it is to be human. Okay? Because there is an issue here of what the subject matter is of sociology. That's kind of what it's, you might say, sort of ontological issue, right? An issue of the domain. One of the things that I argued for in The New Sociological Imagination was that, this idea of social science as kind of a third branch of knowledge somehow in between the humanities and the natural sciences was a very sort of carefully constructed thing in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And there is an issue now of whether its salience is disappearing in the 21st century. Okay. What exactly were the social sciences supposed to be? Let's ask the question that way. In other words, what was the idea? Well, if you look at the humanities, right, the humanities are quite clearly focused on human beings. But traditionally, right, before the social sciences entered the scene, the humanities were really only concerned with the elite members of the human race. And in particular, their products, right? So documents, art, things of that kind, philosophy, the historical record as understood in terms of the famous people who signed treaties and made speeches and stuff of that kind, but pretty much omitted most of the rank and file members of Homo sapiens. Okay, and so when we study the classics, for example, in the humanities, that's still pretty much the picture. And before the social sciences entered the scene, I think it would be fair to say that the view about studying human beings was not every human being was worth listening to. Okay? And so in that respect, one of the innovations of the social sciences, which has in fact influenced the humanities, especially through cultural studies, right, has been to say that, as it were, all human beings are created equal, not only in a legal, ethical sense, but also in an epistemic sense, that they're worth knowing about. Okay? And so the social sciences have been very important in that regard. And they've been very important in that regard, not only on the qualitative side with regard to, you know, talking to people and recording, you know, what they do in their everyday lives and things like that, the sort of ethnographic method, but also on the quantitative side, the whole idea that counting each person as one, okay, and as it were, aggregating, you know, and talking about what most people think, and that's somehow carrying some sort of weight, not only intellectually, but of course politically, with regard to voting, with regard to public opinion, stuff of that kind. That itself is quite a democratizing move. You know, however reductionistic or whatever, you know, swear words one wants to throw at this, mm-hmm. Nevertheless, that actually did pretty much the same thing as the ethnographic approach did in terms of democratizing the whole attitude toward human beings. And those are, as it were, the two signature contributions, you might say, of the social sciences to the study of humanity. Okay. Now, the natural sciences, so that's, you know, social sciences versus humanity. But what about social sciences versus natural sciences? Well, there, of course, you do have the quantitative methods, and you do have a certain kind of democratization, you might say, but one that democratizes across species, right? So in a sense, the way you study human beings is exactly the same way you study animals, and potentially how you study rocks and space and all the rest of it, okay? And so what happens is the distinctiveness of the human disappears in the natural sciences, right? So terms like, you know, the kind of terms that we typically consider to be traditionally marker terms for humans, you know, consciousness, meaningfulness, right, language, welfare, all these kinds of issues, right, in some sense they either get reduced or erased or something under the guise of the natural sciences. And the social sciences, in a way, define themselves by saying, no, there are, as it were, these substantively different entities that, as it were, have their own principles that are not reducible to those of the natural sciences, right? So there is that sense in which the social sciences define itself on that side too, right? So what I've just given you here is kind of what the social sciences were supposed to be about through the late 19th and 20th centuries. Now, the salience of this is disappearing. That's my point, right? There's a sense in which, if you go back to the 19th and 20th century, the thing that most consistently comes out, right, is a certain conception of society as identified with humanity, right? And that, in a sense, and this goes back to Auguste Comte, who I always think, you know, regardless of how much aspersions get cast on Auguste Comte as the founder of sociology because of his political views or whatever, nevertheless, I do think that origin is very important to recall at a time like this, because for him, sociology was the project of humanity, right? And the whole point of society was to bring people into this full level of humanity, raising people up. And this has become, and I suppose from a political standpoint, socialism has been the political project that's most closely identified with this spirit, right? That there is a sense in which society is for all the people and is for enabling people to engage in some sort of sense of self-realization, which they can only do if they are organized in a certain way. Right? And so social science, in a way, is very much focused on that. So if you look at someone like Emil Durkheim, who's got a very clear sense of society as an entity, right, sui generis, not reducible to biological or psychological, right? Right, he thinks of society almost as an organism where there are issues like social problems and things you have to do to get people in line or you know, to enhance them in some way so they can be part of this society. Okay, and this is kind of presupposed in the idea. You know, almost like you might say everyone's worth saving in principle. Okay, and this is why social sciences tended to be sort of left-wing in orientation, concerned about welfare, concerned about the poor, and things of that kind. These kinds of normative presuppositions, which I think operate as kind of default positions within social science, so that if you're not concerned about the poor, if you're not concerned about poverty, if you're quite happy to let people just sort of die, right, then there's a sense where you have to explain yourself if you're a social scientist. If you're a natural scientist, this is not so clear. Because for natural science, especially in a Darwinian worldview, death is natural. Right? Go back to Thomas Malthus. Right? I mean, death is natural. Right? There's always going to be conflict. There's always going to be, you know, there's a sense in which is the normalcy of disruption and so forth. Right? There's a sense in which you just allow it to happen. And that's what the whole, you know, when people took up the sort of Darwinian perspective, which in the 19th century would have completely blurred the line between the social and the biological sciences, right? The ideology attached to that was called laissez-faire. Right? Just let it go. Right? Don't worry about trying to raise people or save people or anything like that. Death is natural. Things will happen. That's just a normal course of things. Okay? There is no point. There is no purpose. Okay? I actually think we are now moving into a position where this could come up again. Okay. One of the reasons why we're moving into this, first of all, I do think it's a great advances in the natural sciences that are taking place, especially in the biological sciences. And I think one of the things that one has to keep in mind here is that biology has massively progressed since the time of Darwin. Okay. And I think it's a lot. It's a bit too easy to dismiss the relevance of biological sciences to the social sciences. And I think one of the things that often social scientists do, that's very lazy, you might say, is to sort of hook on to various biological scientists who happen to be quite cynical or skeptical of their own discipline. So the Stephen Jay Goulds, the Stephen Roses of the world, these kinds of people who say the politically correct things to those of us who are social scientists, we too easily believe them without actually looking at the stuff ourselves. Okay, I think that's, you know, so in other words, we as social scientists do not have our own original takes on the biological research that's going on now. Instead, what we do is we defer to the authority of these guys who have their own axes to grind. Okay, and I think that's really bad news. So, for example, you know, when someone like Stephen Jay Gould used to say before he died that, you know, the scale on which evolutionary change takes place is so vast that it couldn't possibly have any kind of substantive influence on the historical time scale within which, you know, human change takes place, social change takes place. That's rubbish, of course, because we can actually intervene in all kinds of ways without having to wait for evolution to go through its random processes. Right? I mean, the biology can happen much quicker now. We can intervene much more directly. And Gould just was not tuned into that. Okay? Whatever took billions of years to happen, in a certain sense, is kind of irrelevant. Right? And that's why, of course, there's a lot of cultural capital at stake as to how old the Earth is and how did it all happen and stuff like that. And as you know, there are a lot of wars going on about this, cultural wars in across the world. But it seems to me the issue that we need to be concerned about, you know, are the human beings now, and what are the consequences of their being, you know, regarded increasingly as biological entities and our growing capacity to intervene in biological ways that end up having substantive social import? So in a sense, you could reverse billions of years of evolution, you might say, or expedite them, right? I mean, that is something that is within the realm of possibility now. And in a sense, I want to focus on that in the talk, because there is a sense in which no matter, you know, how natural selection played itself out over history, and along, you know, no matter how long all those changes took place that got us to where we are now, there's a certain sense in which that's irrelevant, because we have, you know, we are on board with regard to the future of the way the species and the planet operate. I mean, in a sense, the climate change issue, right? I mean, the whole idea that we could be ending the world in 50 years, even though it's taken so long for the world to get to be the way it is. Okay, I mean, you know, that should, you know, regardless of whether that turns out to be ultimately true, the point is, there, you know, we should be alert to that. The fact that things have happened a certain way in the past doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to take forever for the next major changes to happen. Okay, so social scientists need to have kind of original views on these matters and not just to rely on what other biologists are saying. Okay, I think that's very important. In addition, there's also the research that is actually occurring within fields of biology that impinge on the human condition, and so you may know about fields like evolutionary psychology. You may have heard of that field. And that field, in a way, is kind of a politically correct descendant of what used to be known when I was a kid as sociobiology, with E.O. Wilson. Some of you old enough may remember this. Right. And so the idea here, you know, I mean, this is already in Darwin, and Darwin recognized very clearly that, as it were, we are by nature social. By nature social. Right? And that there are certain kinds of natural ways of being social, you might say. And there's variation among various species. And in a sense, the human condition, you might say, is an amalgam of different aspects of what different species in the past have been like. And so if you read a book, for example, like E.O. Wilson's book, Sociobiology, The New Synthesis, which came out when I was an undergraduate at Columbia 30-something years ago, you know, what that book basically does is it goes through various kinds of species and, as it were, identifies, you might say, precedents for things that you see in human behavior that have an evolutionary ancestor. You know, so sometimes we're like insects, sometimes we're like wolves, sometimes we're like apes, you know, this kind of thing. And that there are precedents there, and one would expect there to be some kind of genetic component that one could identify that is similar with those creatures, because ultimately, of course, we overlap in terms of genetic makeup with the other animals, whatever, 95-97%. So there's going to be a lot of overlap here, okay? And so it's not surprising that there would be all this kind of overlap also in behavior patterns across the species, okay? Now, the overall effect of this kind of research, which has become increasingly sophisticated over the last 30-35 years with evolutionary psychology, is that the traditional distinctions, the things that I was mentioning earlier that distinguish the social sciences from the natural sciences, like, you know, meaningfulness and consciousness and rationality and language and all that kind of stuff, they're being erased, right? There's a sense in which what the psychologists are coming up with, the evolutionary psychologists, they're coming up with more and more sophisticated experimental protocols to be able to tap into what the animals are doing. So in a sense, in the past, you might say, the reason why it was so easy to show the animals didn't do language was because we weren't really tuned into them very well. And in a sense, we had a very, you might say, anthropomorphic kind of sense of how the animals ought to be responding if they actually have language. But maybe we need to be a little more sophisticated. Maybe we need to abstract a little bit from the phenomena. We need to take more seriously, you know, the physiological capabilities, and then say, okay, an organism with this kind of physiological capability, how might it have something as complex as language, and then do the experiment? And so as a result, we now have much more sophisticated experiments and much more sophisticated understandings. And while all the barriers by no means have been broken, nevertheless, you know, the differences are being narrowed. I mean, there was an interesting article that was published in Science a few years ago, one of the co-authors of which was Noam Chomsky. Where Noam Chomsky, now if you know about Noam Chomsky's views about language, you know, Chomsky is a guy who definitely believes language distinguishes humans from other animals, right? And Chomsky even talks about language as an organ, right? As if it were this kind of, you know, he's a Cartesian, right? He believes there's this like special thing we've got that no other creatures have. And you know, and actually, this is hooked up with some of Chomsky's theological views. He does, in that respect, he's kind of a special creationist with regard to humans in terms of language, okay? But even Chomsky has had to admit in this article in Science that that what exactly that consists in is now, as it were, more modest, right? It's not, the gulf is not quite as big as he thought it was when he first formulated his theories in the 1960s, okay? So when Chomsky's making concessions, okay, then you know we're in trouble. Okay, because he's kind of the most radical out there guy with regard to wanting to maintain the distinctiveness of the human with regard to the issue of language. You know, now I say this because I think this is something that we need to really be tuned into here. First of all, because I don't think it's going to work anymore, and I'm always very, you know, like, Jürgen Habermas is a nice old man. Full stop. Right? But his views about language and communication and everything, sorry, they're not up to date. You, I mean, I understand why he's doing it. He's obviously trying to ground something about the nature of humanity, the distinctiveness of our condition, and so forth. He's someone who's got a lot at stake, as well he should, and as well we should, about being able to come up with some sort of sophisticated, informative definition of humanity. And, you know, this idea of this kind of communicative condition business. Yes, okay, nice, very nice, but outdated. It's got to be redefined, reformulated in light of what we are learning now. Otherwise, it just looks like you're sticking your head in the sand. And I'm afraid that's often what social scientists do with regard to this new biological stuff. And that's why guys like Stephen Jay Gould and Stephen Rose are so handy, because they give them the automatic excuse not to deal with the biological literature themselves. Okay? So this is, as it were, the challenge, right? What is distinctive about humanity? Right, that requires a distinct body of knowledge called the social sciences, that we ought to be teaching students that isn't reducible to some branch of the natural sciences. Of course, another reason for doing this is, of course, these natural scientists, these biologists, are in fact already teaching stuff about what we teach. Okay? So, for example, my guess is that one of the most popular books to find out about the nature of social life today is Steven Pinker's The Blank Slate. Okay, Steven Pinker is a developmental linguist at Harvard who's a professional reputation has to do primarily with understanding how language develops in kids. But he's become this great champion of evolutionary psychology, and you know he's written a lot of popular books over the last 10, 15 years or so. And then there was this book that came out in 2002 called The Blank Slate, which is a head-on refutation of what he calls the standard social science model. And this is this phrase, SSSM, standard social science model, is something that's used throughout the literature of evolutionary psychology and sociobiology to demonize social science, to stereotype social scientists. And the idea is the standard social science model is that you explain everything in social life in terms of environmental context, in terms of differences. You presume no universals. Okay, everything's explained in terms of differences in context and environment. Okay, and Pinker's book is basically about debunking this idea, and also not only debunking the idea as a research approach, but also debunking its politics, which is another interesting aspect of this. Because Pinker believes that if your social science is so oriented toward explaining things in terms of differences between environments and people and so forth, that you're just going to end up having impossibly high standards for what you can do in politics, right? And this is where you get all the atrocities that are associated with totalitarian regimes, where people think people are plastic, right? You give them a different environment, they become totally different. Okay, so he's really weighing, and for him, Marxism, social constructivism, they're all the same in this respect. Right? They're all of these worldviews where basically they say, look, you can make people to order by some means or other. Behaviorism, they're all the same. Right? So behaviorism, Marxism, social constructivism, maybe people in this audience think of these views as somewhat different from each other, but from the standpoint of Steven Pinker and all of these evolutionary psychologists, they're all the same view. Because they all have this thing about the environment making a big difference in what people are like. Right? And that people can be molded into shape. And what, for Pinker, this means is you end up getting this kind of impossibly high standard of utopian politics, which then ends up justifying all kinds of atrocities, because if people don't change to order, then it's not because the theory is wrong, it's because the people are being stubborn. Right? And the various failures of socialism, totalitarianism, whatever, and these are all, again, amalgamated together, should indicate that there is a limit to how far political change can go, because there's a limit to what human beings can be. And that's where the universal aspect, the genetic aspect of human beings, becomes a relevant consideration for any kind of normative project. Now, the thing about this that's really pernicious, and there's a lot of pernicious things about this, but the really pernicious thing is all these people, Steven Pinker, E.L. Wilson's another one who's also, I mentioned him earlier, he's also on this line. These are all people who consider themselves liberal or left. These are not conservatives. Okay? These are realistic, center, liberal, left people. Okay? And this really gives you a sense of the sort of changing tenor. I mean, if you really want a book that encapsulates this entire change in worldview that I think we really need to come to grips with very directly, I would recommend you look at this little pamphlet that Peter Singer, the animal rights philosopher, published now 10 years ago, 1999, called A Darwinian Left. A Darwinian Left. And this is an explicit argument. It was published in a series that the London School of Economics puts out on evolutionary topics. They're these small books. You've probably seen them in bookshops. Weidenfeld and Nicholson published them. They're less than 100 pages long. They're very, very, it's like 30,000 word little tracts. And this one basically is an argument for people on the left replacing Marx with Darwin. and then correspondingly scale down one's sense of what is politically possible. Okay. And on top of that, you see, it isn't just a sense. See, there are two things going on. It isn't just a sense that, you know, somebody like Pinker or Singer or Wilson are saying that social scientists have kind of the wrong take on social causation and therefore it affects their politics. But there's also an argument about the changing status of human beings in this vis-a-vis other aspects of nature. So it's not just an issue of, you know, in other words, this is not just an issue internal to social science, but it's an issue about, you know, this reflects a sort of larger consideration about what are human beings vis-a-vis the rest of nature. Because, of course, the whole business about human beings being so plastic, you know, Marx talking about this being homo faber, man the maker, right, was a distinctive feature of human beings in contrast to other creatures in nature who were very much pretty much as they were built, right? That they were just kind of these machines, these, you know, things that were manufactured to behave a certain way and really can't change and really can't make progress and so forth, right? But human beings, by virtue of their plasticity, can actually become much more than they start out as, right? And that's always the great hope of progress, right, that you find throughout the modern period. But this is what's being denied here, right, as part of a general move to reabsorb the human back into nature. Right, then in a sense, just as there are limits to the other species in terms of what they can do, and sure, you know, there's a sense in which, you know, cockroaches live all over the place, right, all kinds of different environments, but there are limits to what cockroaches can do by virtue of being cockroaches, no matter where they're living. Well, likewise, one should think of human beings in a similar way. Human beings live all over the place, lots of different environments, but there are limits to how they actually respond to those environments. Okay, so it's part of a reabsorption of the human into nature. That is also what's going on here, right? Which then raises this question about, if you're a social scientist, what is distinctive about what you're teaching that couldn't be taught by a sociobiologist, an evolutionary psychologist, you know, one of these biological anthropologists, and so forth. Okay? And I think that question is going to come out more and more and more in the future, not only because of these intellectual developments, but also because of the political economy of academic life, namely where universities are not very strong, in terms of, especially in terms of maintaining their structural components, i.e. disciplines. Okay? Back in the old days, when universities were being supported on a more or less taken for granted basis, sort of default basis, the idea would be that, you know, however the university was divided up would be how it would continue to be divided up. So one could always rely on a certain amount of inertia, you might say, keeping your discipline, you know, justified. But now, right, every year we need to justify our disciplines. Okay. And of course, part of the way to do that is to say, well, you know, what kind of teaching provision are you providing, and can somebody else provide it? Okay? And I don't think we're very far away from a time where it will be possible for biological anthropologists, evolutionary psychologists, a whole host of people on the borderline lands between the social and biological sciences, being able to claim as their pedagogical jurisdiction stuff that we currently teach. And saying that they're more advanced, more up to date, they can plug into more stuff, that, you know, they're more relevant to more things, etc., etc. Okay, so there's a real, so there's that issue too. There's this background political economy issue, which has broken down disciplinary boundaries within the university, which in a way encourages these more ambitious fields to actually start conquering neighboring lands. Okay? So that's the other thing, too. So we don't have any natural protection within the university for our fields, even if our fields have been around for a long time and have been doing perfectly well, understood in their own terms. There's now always these bigger markets that we're being pushed into where we have to compete with players we didn't, you know, we didn't want to compete with or anticipate competing with. Okay? So that's an important issue, too. Now, the other issue that also ought to be kept in the back of one's mind is, you might say, the enemy within problem, within the social sciences. The extent to which the social sciences have been very self-undermined. Okay? Because I think one of the things that's clear is, of course, you know, we do have, you know, the social sciences, in a way, has a very strong tradition of criticism and critique, especially social critique, and in fact that's very much part of the progressive leftist agenda that's associated with social science, and one of the things that makes it a very distinctive body of knowledge. But at the same time, of course, that critique gets turned inward, especially when the original projects start to fail. Right? I mean, you know, so Mark, you know, after the Russian Revolution, people are dissatisfied with it, all of a sudden the Marxist critique goes back home, right, and then just gets sort of planted in the academy, and you've got the Frankfurt School and everything after that, okay? And of course what we have now, two, three generations after the Frankfurt School, is we've got postmodernism, okay? And postmodernism, you know, is a really mixed blessing, okay? Because one of the things that postmodernism does is, you know, we all know, is it blurs boundaries, it breaks down binaries, right? The kinds of border issues that we're talking about here that actually have traditionally given the social science the clear identity, that is to say, a clear idea that there is a humanity that is distinct from animals and includes everyone we would normally call Homo sapiens, those kinds of moves, right, are exactly the kind of thing that postmodernism challenges. Those kinds of boundary construction moves. Okay. And so not surprisingly, right, within the postmodern side of our field, we find people saying, well, you know, the human, non-human distinction, you know, what's the difference? I mean, you know, it's blurred. I mean, everything can have agency, right? You know, all these kinds of notions where traditionally it would be just the preserve of human beings. Now, these properties get spread, they get distributed much more widely, much more thinly, you might say, than they have in the past. And so what that does, and I come from this field of science studies, you know, where the sociology of science becomes very interdisciplinary, and one of the things that we do, the empirical side of the field does, is to study science in action, as Bruno Latour says. And one of the consequences of that is that you start to see lots of different players, lots of different actors, and what exactly is causing what exactly exercises agency becomes a very open kind of question. How, you know, what you don't have at the end of this kind of analysis is any clear sense that there's a distinctive human agency, that there's a distinctive side called society that's separate from something else. Right? Everything is kind of blurred. Now, when everything is blurred, and this gets presented in my field as very much a strength, right? Because what it does is it actually breaks down traditional disciplinary barriers that had made it difficult for social and natural sciences to work with each other, okay? So, for example, in my field, you know, these terms that are such big terms in mainstream sociology, you know, race, class, gender, you know, all the biggies, right? Those things really are kind of under erasure, as we say, right? I mean, they're not, I mean, they're words. They're words. You know, they're like rhetorical tokens. You know, they get mobilized, but they're not real, right? And that becomes very useful if you're actually trying to deal with people who don't want to be hit in the face with heavy ontology. Right? You want a kind of approach to studying the world that isn't going to have to bring in a lot of baggage, saying you have to believe in this kind of conception of what social is, et cetera, in order to work with me. And so we are very, what I have called in the past, a theory life field. We're very theory-like. We can, you know, it's one of the, and then it makes it easy for you to work with anyone. But then the question is, you know, in whose department are you working in? Right? And that's where the political economy of the university starts to kick in. Right? Who exactly has got the power? Who's got the funds? Okay? And a lot of people in my field now find themselves working in, like, environmental studies programs. Right? In other words, programs that, as it were, you might say have a natural science foundation, but have a kind of social edge to them. I guess that would be the way it would look like from the outside. And there's an increasing number of those kinds of fields, and they're very good fields to kind of create from the standpoint of funding, because they're good funding attractors fields of that kind, given the way in which the funding categories are organized these days for research. Okay? So I think we, you know, so this is kind of, in a sense, what I'm giving you here is kind of how I see where we are now in the beginning of the 21st century. And when I pose this question to a lot of younger colleagues, I mean, see, one of the interesting things about this audience, I have to say, is that you guys are teachers. And teachers, I think, in a way, may feel the significance of this more than people who are in research. Because one of the interesting things about people who are primarily in research and don't do much teaching is they can, you know, as long as they're doing projects that they find intellectually interesting, they could be anywhere, right? Because in a sense, they're sort of ideologically uncommitted, especially people on short-term contracts. Right? And it becomes very important in order to increase your mobility and increase your viability as someone who can get jobs, you know, after every 2-3 year period is over, right? You've got to be able to plug into various things. So it becomes very important that you are ideologically light, right? That you're, you know, that you're not a heavy Marxist who's going to start having nightmares about who's funding you and stuff. Right? So it becomes, you know, and but of course, the way disciplines are created and maintained at the teaching level does come from having such nightmares, right? It does come from thinking, you know, what is social, what is not social, right? You know, being very kind of concerned about that, and your identity gets very much wrapped up into it. I had a student who recently finished a PhD, she interviewed sociologists in institutions across the range, from, you know, the very top-end research to primarily teaching-oriented places in this country, and asking him what it means to be a sociologist, and can you still be a sociologist today, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it was quite clear that the identity of being a sociologist, right, was tied up with the teaching side, where one was actually passing on a certain way of seeing the world and so forth to students. But the people who primarily thought of themselves as researchers, who felt they were increasingly being pushed into a research track, for them, sociology was not so relevant as a category. For them, it's just a word. You know, it might work for one grant, might not work for another. You know, they'll just go. You know, go to a management school. Hey, where are we? And they'll go somewhere else, right? They're not ideologically committed. You know, because you know there is this issue from a sort of a praxis standpoint. Where how does ideological commitment get constructed? Well, teaching is really the way, right? Where you're there in the classroom actually repeating all this stuff and your students are listening to it and having to say it too, right? I mean, it is kind of like indoctrination, you might say. Well, that's exactly how a disciplinary consciousness gets produced. But if you're not in that setting, and if that setting is the kind of thing you want to avoid because you really want to do research, right, then it seems to me there is a question about how the discipline's going to survive. Okay? Because, see, as I was saying before, when I talk to the younger people who are researchers, primarily researchers, and most of the audience is, you know, researchers that I talk to, they don't see this problem that I'm saying. They just see what I'm, because the first question I get is, why are you presenting this as so bad? Why are you presenting this is a problem? This is progress, what you're describing. We're finally letting go of those 19th century suckers like Marx, Weber, and Durkheim. Right? Can't you see that, man? What's the problem? Well, I know, you know, there's an issue. You know, what is the problem? You know, what exactly is being, what has been lost in the translation as we've moved across the centuries? I mean, I gotta say, you know, at Warwick University, where I am, you know, we've got all these wonderful students and everything. We still teach the first year course, you know, Marx, Weber, Durkheim, basically, you know, and then we start off that way, just like everybody else does. But there is an issue, right, when you then move on to the following courses and how this exactly hooks up to what we're talking about now, and one always does get the sense, and certainly when you look at the run of, you know, kind of introductory theory textbooks that are around now, that people are really straining very often to show the relevance of these 19th century guys to what's happening now, right? There's a lot of straining going on. And this is not an argument for abandoning sociology as an idea or anything of that kind, or social sciences as a body of knowledge, but it is an argument for saying that, you know, we cannot really rely on those 19th century guys as crutches. We've got to really reinvent this stuff, you know, for the 21st century. So if you look at, for example, you know, Durkheim's Rules of the Sociological Method, right, you know, there's a book where he's quite clearly, you know, saying, okay, this is psychology, this is biology, right? You know, he's laying it out, you know, circa whatever, 1895, 1897, whatever, right? Well, there's a sense in which that needs to be done for 2009, right? That exercise has to be conducted for 2009, not to just quote Durkheim, because the whole ballgame's changed, okay? And the arguments have to be reinvented. Biology's different, psychology's different, all the fields are different. But the argument's got to be reinvented somehow, okay? And I think that's really That is really the challenge, okay? I mean, if you recall, you know, Anthony Giddens wrote the new rules of the sociological method 37 years ago, right? And the thing about that book, right, which in a way, it does not do this at all, what I'm suggesting, right? It does the opposite. It basically says, yes, there's biology out there, but, as it were, there's a clear line. He just takes it for granted there's a clear line. Right? So for example, sociology doesn't deal with evolution. Right? He's very explicit about that. Right? There's a clear line. There's this biological stuff. And I think he's operating under this kind of Stephen Jay Gould idea that, as it were, yes, there's this kind of prehistory by which we get to be human beings, which the biologists can deal with. But then once you get into historical time, then that's the domain of social life, and the biology's out. That's what he's saying over, 1976 or whenever that book came out. So he doesn't engage with the biology at all. He just draws a line and presumes that people are going to recognize it for what it is. And I just don't think, you cannot rely on that anymore, even though I constantly see sociologists doing this, in terms of how you define the social. But there's some natural line between the social and the biology. There is no natural line. The line has got to be constructed actively, and let me tell you, the guys on the other side, they're constructing it already for purposes of their own designs. So they're just incorporating us. And one of the ways you see this, and this is where those of you who have PhD students or take an interest in this personally, if you look, it would be great to go through a book like Steven Pinker's The Blank Slate or E.O. Wilson's book Consilience, which is a book about unifying knowledge, where he basically says that social science is a residue of theology, essentially, and that needs to be gotten rid of. And look at, they've got extensive notes, both of these books. And these books cite extensively social science research, but they do so in a way that they just keep the data and strip off the theory and method. This is typically the way in which these guys in the biological sciences operate, okay? So in other words, the method, the theories of the social sciences are what are the marks of identity in terms of reflecting the degree of sophistication and complexity that one has to deal with human subjects as objects of study. And this gets completely stripped off when the biologists pick up the data. They just pick up this data and then they give their alternative explanations to it. Okay? Often subsumed under explanatory frameworks where the other bodies of evidence that confirm it are from other species. Okay? And the interesting thing is, I'm always a little surprised that social scientists have not really directly criticized this technique. Because you can just put a student on this, go through the footnotes, go back to the original articles, and just look at how there's all this stripping of data going on, essentially, by these evolutionary psychologists and sociobiologists. It's part of a fight-back strategy on our part. Because at the moment, we're just rolling over. We just think these guys are going to go away, or no one's going to take them seriously, or I don't know what. But there is no concerted effort to even deal with this. Okay? And I have to tell you, it's even been difficult trying to get the ESRC engaged in this, because I recently did program evaluation for all the science and society projects the ESRC commissioned over the last 5 years. And, one of the things I said, you really should have training seminars or something whereby social scientists will spend a dedicated amount of time, maybe in the summer, to get up to speed on all this biological stuff so they could then, bring it into their own teaching and research in a critical, informed fashion. Okay, haven't gotten any takers for this yet, but this is really what we're talking about here, so that we can make sure we just don't get rolled over. Because I think this could very easily happen, okay, in the current climate that we're in. How much more time do I have?
You've hit 45.
I hit 45? Okay, I'll stop here then. How about that? And I'll just take questions.
Okay,
thanks.
I agree with your idea of the problem of the sort of theory light stuff, and I think in terms of A-level sociology we're guilty of that because you get family, education, religion and crime, and that's been the way the thing has developed. So we're kind of quite guilty of that, something I've tried to argue against but not very successfully for mine. But I don't particularly actually agree necessarily with your dismissal of the sort of enlightenment of Jürgen Habermas. I think there is still something in the notion of the idea of progress, in the notion of the idea of choice. And I think, you know, if you look at the sort of stuff on the spirit level by Wilkinson, you've got an illustration of different types of societies, USA, Sweden, you know, classic example, but nonetheless, it represents something that enables us to construct very different visions of different societies that have real material consequences for people. I think that's something that should be defended as the purview of social science. You seem to be, I don't know, sort of saying, okay, all this is going on, and the world has changed, so we've got a kind of postmodern ontology, and you're searching for a modernist epistemology. And I can't quite see where that's coming from. I personally don't think we've moved on to a postmodernist ontology. So I don't particularly have that problem, but it seems I can't quite see how you square the circle and where you want. Somebody, I can't remember their name, sort of said, you know, the point is to change the world. But seems fair enough and relevant. I'm sure you are trying to, but you know, what are we doing? Because yes, we're being taken over by the psychologists, and I entirely agree with you about that. And my colleagues in the psychology department had a textbook, and on the chapter on sex, there was this drawing of the female and male sexual organs. God only knows what that's doing in the psychology textbook, but it illustrates the extent to which the biological end of things is indeed getting in at A level, which I think, you know, we need to resist. Although
she said resist. I mean, there might be more, rather than just simply resisting, there could be more constructive responses. Right, rather than acting, it's not there. Let me pick up a couple of your points. Yes, there are these different ways in which societies can be, like you were saying, but I think the point that the biologists will always throw back at you is that those differences are relatively narrow. You know, in other words, that there's something fundamental within which they have to remain. There are constraints within which the differences can occur. And I think we need to have a kind of response to that sort of move, okay? So in a sense, Freud talked about the narcissism of small differences. This may be what sociology is, right? From a standpoint of biology. Right, there's a sense in which, you know, are you forest and trees, what's the issue here? I think we need to have some sort of answer to that kind of objection. Now, in terms of whether we live in a postmodern world or not, maybe I'm speaking, my vice chancellor, Nigel Fritt, is ultra postmodern. He's a postmodern theorist, and he's running our university. And I don't think that's surprising, okay? No, but I don't think that's surprising because universities have become very postmodern entities in the sense that they've become very fluid in terms of their institutional boundaries, right, in terms of their internal structures. Nothing seems to be fixed or static anymore. Everything seems to be up for grabs. And that's why, you know, groups of people who are able to mobilize resources effectively at key moments can end up having enormous amount of power on the ground. Because you can't, universities are no longer these kinds of, you know, reproduced institutional types of things where you could, you know, comfortably count on your discipline remaining in existence for several generations. It's no longer like that. If anything's become postmodern, it's been the university. And that's why I think there is something to be concerned about. Because you may go on teaching your courses the way you do, but the name of your department may change and may have all kinds of different implications with regard to how you're positioned in the system. You know, so the world might change around you. You can continue teaching your course the way you want, but you'll be in some other, you'll find yourself in the natural sciences before you know it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed your talk, as I knew I would, and it was extraordinarily challenging, I think, for all of us. But dare I ask a really simple question, yeah, which is a really complex question. What do you actually see as distinctively human?
Well, see, this is the other part of the talk I didn't talk about. This is the part of the talk I was at when I came into the room I thought I was going to say. What I just gave you 45 minutes was a preamble. No, but it's a very good advertisement for that book I wrote back in 2008, which I wasn't going to play. I said, we'll just use this as a dummy title. I won't actually talk about this. I'll talk about something else. No, I did talk about this. I do think the thing I need to talk about, and I'm not going to give another 45-minute lecture here, but I do think that on the science policy agendas on both sides of the Atlantic at the moment, there is this thing called ENVIC. Have people heard about this acronym, ENVIC? Does this mean anything to anyone?
No.
Does the concept of converging technologies mean anything? A little bit, okay. Well, here's the idea. At the level of the European Union and the U.S. National Science Foundation, there are, you might say there are, you know, science policy operates at many different levels, but there's a, you might say, a meta level, a kind of, you know, regulative ideals under which, you know, what would be the right kinds of projects to be proposing. And on both sides of the Atlantic now, there is this sense of we need to have projects in the natural and social sciences that are designed to enhance human performance. And that's what converging technology is about. And so NBIC means nano, bio, info, cogno. And the idea is to get research in all of these fields focused, consolidated, provide incentives for them to kind of synthesize into converging technologies that can enable us to live longer, work harder. That would be part of the way we relieve the pensions crisis, actually. The serious practical issues that are being that are in the back of people's minds. But there's a very strong initiative to do this. And one way in which you may have registered this agenda, which is, you know, I'm describing it now as it's happening kind of in the, you know, top-level science policy. I was part of a European Union framework project on the knowledge politics of this. So I've interviewed a lot of these science policy guys, and I've got an article on this. If anyone's interested, they can contact me. But where you see this happening kind of at a more grassroots public level is every year at examination time when you get the bioethicist professor at Manchester University, John Harris, who wrote a book a couple of years ago called Enhancing Evolution, saying, let kids have brain-boosting drugs at exam time. Right? That why not? They want it. They should have it. You know, boost people's performance in sports. Go to it. You know? You know, I mean, and so there is a kind of environment that is creating expectations along these lines. This is kind of where we should be going. And there's research that is encouraging this kind of move. Now you might say, well, how much of this is real? How much of it is speculative? Well, some of it is real, but the interesting thing is the momentum in favor of it that's happening at many different levels, not just at the science policy levels, but also at the level of these guys like Harris who are intervening in newspaper debates and things like that, pushing the argument along. And so then this raises the question about what it means to be human. Because so many of our, you know, activities and our practices that define us as human have to do with certain normative notions of performance, right? And what this thing does is it pushes the boundary of that, okay? And some of it in a quite substantial way. So, for example, you know, experimenting with ways of artificializing your existence to a large extent, turning yourself into a prosthetic device, essentially. Uploading your consciousness and things like this. I mean, of course, this stuff is not yet technologically viable, but the interesting thing is expectations have been created, research is being commissioned, movies are being produced, right? The point is there is a kind of forward momentum along these lines, but what there isn't at the moment is really any kind of substantive sociological thinking about what is this so-called transhuman existence supposed to be like, how is it to be governed, and so forth, okay? Because at the moment, we've got a phrase in the field I'm in, science studies, which I think is a euphemism, called anticipatory governance. Anticipatory governance. Okay? If you look at this project as it's funded in the United States, which is funded through the Nanotechnology Initiative of the National Science Foundation, so it's funded through the natural science side, enormous percentage of the people who are funded into this program are social scientists, okay? And in fact, they constitute quite a large percentage of all the social scientists funded by the National Science Foundation are funded through this, okay? And they are engaged in research having to do with anticipatory governance. In fact, there are some researchers in this country who are hooked up to the guys who do it in America. Anticipatory governance is when you conduct focus groups and run scenarios to get people's views about all of this futuristic stuff that I've been alluding to. Okay, for purposes of figuring out what is it that scares them, what is it that they like about it, right? Get a sense of their attitudes, both pro and con. And then what you do is you send it back to Washington, right? And then, of course, you know, it gets delivered back as a PR spin, right? How to exactly position this stuff so people aren't too scared, you know, so it doesn't you know, because especially the Americans are very mindful of the disaster of genetically modified foods in Europe, right? The Americans are very mindful, because it didn't happen in America, this problem, but it happened in Europe. And so there's a sense in which public relations needs to be managed from early on. And so what better way to do it than to hire all of these wonderful social scientists who are very sophisticated in all these wonderful methods to engage in anticipatory governance, right? To know in advance. It's kind of like, you know, creating an immune system from all of the objections that could come up later down the road. Okay? So this is kind of how social science is participating at the moment in this process. I think there are more intelligent ways for us to be participating than this. But this is what happens when you end up having a sort of social science research culture that is short-termist and market-driven. You know, they got the skills, where are the jobs, there they go. They're not committed to a discipline, they're not committed to some sort of consciousness of what sociology is or humanity is or anything like that. They follow the money. And why shouldn't they? Right? Because there's a sense in which they're not given any kind of clear sense of what it is that one should be standing for as a sociologist or a social scientist. Okay? So at the moment, this is what social scientists are doing as far as this enhancing humanity stuff is doing. It's basically paving the road for its acceptance. That's the way I look at it. Some people think I'm being cynical. I don't think that's true. Because even if you write a vaguely critical article, and this is the beautiful thing about postmodernism, it's never really critical, right? It's always ambivalent. Right? Ambivalent. You know, I'm super sophisticated, I'm going to say nothing. You know? And this is wonderful, because what you end up doing in the process is you actually do lay out all the data on all sides, and so the policymakers, who are really your clients, right, they're the ones who are really serving at the end, more than the peer review process or your colleagues or anything like that, they can take this stuff and do what they will with it. So you're actually providing an enormous amount of information for them. And you're saying, I'm being ambivalent, I'm keeping a study distance. No, you're just being a bloody old-fashioned empiricist. That's what you're doing. You know, and I think that's most postmodern research is of that kind, right? Except it has a little more jargon and maybe more poorly written than the old empiricist stuff was. But it's pretty much the same thing, in fact, I'm afraid to say, okay? But that's what's going on at the moment, okay? Now, when you talk to the social theorists about this and say, hey, social theorists, you should be paying attention to this. You should, you know, okay, risk society, that's a beautiful thing, right? But let's move on. Right? No. They tell you, they get extremely smug and say, oh, come on, this is just part of that techno-utopian natural science thing, and they start trotting out a Dornan Horkheimer at you as if that's going to scare you, you know? And they don't want to deal with it. They don't think it's serious enough to deal with. Okay? And that's the real problem, because what you do need is you need the academic sociologists, the social theorists, the really critical people to take this stuff sufficiently seriously that they actually criticize it, rather than ignore it, or laugh at it, or dismiss it. Okay? But we need to have our own views on the matter. Okay? And I think this is going to become more and more important. And you can see how this goes. If more and more social scientists are being employed in this kind of capacity, this really changes the whole, you know, complexion of what the field's about. We become a kind of service field for the natural sciences. Right? Because the thing that social scientists will always have, and this is, in fact, the thing that I think sells a lot of the stuff in science studies to people outside of our field, is the methods are pretty sophisticated. We have sophisticated ways of getting at things, much more so than the natural scientists themselves have. But then what you're doing is you're basically just delivering these captive audiences to the policymakers. That's what you're doing. Yeah, exactly. I mean, those of you with long memories may recall that in the Society for Social Problems in the 1960s in the United States, Alvin Guldner, who was elected president at one point, you know, gave this inaugural address against Howard Becker, right, for doing just that, right, with the symbolic interaction stuff. And I think, you know, we need to revisit that kind of worry, okay? And that we need our own kind of, you know, Guldner was certainly one guy who tried to establish a kind of critical, independent, sociological, social science standpoint, right, that did not ignore what was happening in the world, but took a very clearly defined, self-recognizably sociological perspective on it. And you see, that's the thing that's lacking now, something, you know, is that kind of an initiative. Otherwise, I think we just end up becoming reduced, you know, to data collectors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
my first lesson with my new lower six on Monday, and it's the dreaded kind of what is sociology.
And you're not going to say what was sociology.
I reflect on my teaching now. There's a load of evolutionary psychology in there, because Mark mentioned the spirit level. If you look at the stuff that they use to explain the data, most of that is evolutionary psychology,
That's right.
And that's coming into my teaching. What should I tell my students? what is sociology?
Well, the problem is that there's now no off-the-shelf answer. I think the best you can do in the short term is to maybe remind them that the field did get established by drawing distinctions from biology. Because look, you know, you go back to Durkheim and Weber, you know, there are clear lines being drawn, certainly against Darwin, from both of those thinkers, right? I mean, Durkheim vis-a-vis Spencer, actually, and Weber vis-a-vis Darwin. And so you could say, you know, sociologists are now trying to redefine their terrain in light of the way in which biology has developed over the last 150 years. But basically, it seems to me that's really what's at play. Because the day you really do accept the evolutionary psychology explanations as proper social explanations, then you've given away the game, it seems to me. Then then Durkheim and Weber are gone. Right? I mean, but the point is you can't just repeat their names as mantras. That's the problem. You have to kind of reinvent what they did, you know, in the 1890s, right, for our own time. But that is really what the mission is. Because the day you accept that evolutionary psychology stuff, sociology disappears.
Yeah. Can I just say, I mean, I'm just thinking back to, similar to yourself, I'm reflecting back onto my own teaching practices. I did my degree at the LSE, and they offer you a wide range of options about what you want to do as part of your sociology degree. I did German, I did English literature, I did psychoanalysis of racism, and I did international history. Uh-huh. So basically, I did a whole wide variety of subjects with a kind of aim to kind of maybe just get an understanding of where kind of we get maybe some kind of sociology from. But it's interesting because obviously when I deliver it, my students don't have that understanding that I've done it with the aim of doing that.
Yeah.
But actually they're just getting it as a different subject.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting for me.
Yeah.
What
final
question?
It's sort of interesting that it sort of reflects a lot of what I've sort of been teaching for sort of 10 years now, and it's sort of interesting that I think sociology particularly seems quite keen on giving stuff away, you know? They want to give it over to people who teach communication, you know, no offense to anybody who does these things, communication studies, you know, in our colleges, in English, you know? So, well, you can do that, and yeah, it's so much of sociology, and all of these other kind of things like media studies, et cetera, just takes, and we've got, you know, bare bones left, really.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And frankly, this would be happening even at a university like Warwick if our disciplinary boundaries weren't so strong that makes it actually difficult for stuff to kind of move across borders. You know, we always complain about disciplinary boundaries being so rigid but actually that kind of helps us at times like this.
Okay, can we thank Steve for